Nemoto presents Addiction: Temperance, the First Culture War. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 16 minutes. The winter evening was cold in a Midwestern town circa 1910. A woman stood by a front window, her shawl pulled tight, watching the empty street and waiting for her husband to return from the saloon. The children slept in their beds, but she knew that when he finally stumbled in, often well past midnight, there might be trouble. He had once been gentle and steady. Over the years, whiskey had changed him. A payday binge could mean an empty pantry, a slammed door, a bruise. She had seen enough to feel her heart pound with dread, and then harden into resolve. This could not continue. A few blocks away, a small congregation of women gathered outside the roughest tavern in town. They were not there to drink. They were there to be seen and heard. They held Bibles in their gloved hands and sang hymns into the icy air, imploring the men inside to go home. A door swung open, laughter spilled out, and a burly patron peered into the night, only to recognize his own wife among the singers. His swagger faltered. He muttered and shut the door. The women kept singing. One held the hand of a child, perhaps hoping the sight alone might cut through the noise and smoke inside. This was not a spontaneous outburst but part of a growing crusade to protect families from what they called the demon rum. By the early 20th century, the United States was deep in the throes of what many saw as an epidemic of alcoholism. Saloons dotted every city and small town, often open from dawn until late at night. Heavy drinking, especially by men, was commonplace, and public drunkenness, domestic violence, and workplace accidents related to alcohol were on the rise. The country was also undergoing rapid transformations. There was breakneck industrial growth, which meant people flooding into crowded cities to work in factories. There were new immigrants arriving with their own drinking customs: German beer gardens, Irish pubs, Italian wine at dinner. Social norms were being upended, and many Americans felt a kind of moral panic amid these changes. To a lot of them, the bottle became the symbol of all that was going wrong. The factory worker who drank his wages and could not feed his family, the young hoodlums causing trouble under the influence, the corrupt city politicians in cahoots with saloon owners. Out of this stew of concern, the temperance movement gained incredible momentum. It started earlier in the 19th century as a call for moderation. But as the years passed and alcohol problems seemed ever more dire, the movement's message hardened into one of total prohibition. Driving this movement were often women. Women and children bore the brunt of alcohol's destructive side. They were the ones left hungry if the paycheck was drunk away, or bruised and terrified by an abusive alcoholic husband, at a time when women had virtually no legal recourse or rights within marriage. In 1874, these concerns coalesced into a formidable organization, the Women's Christian Temperance Union. If a woman of that era had suffered because of alcohol, joining the WCTU gave her a chance to fight back. Under the leadership of dynamic figures like Frances Willard, the WCTU spread a powerful message that God and goodness were on the side of temperance. They marched, they prayed, they lobbied local officials to shut down bars. Some even took direct action into their own hands, the most famous example being Carrie Nation, a stout middle-aged woman in Kansas who believed she was on a mission from God to destroy saloons. Wielding a hatchet, she would stride into taverns unannounced, smash every bottle and barrel in sight, and berate the drinkers for their sins. These dramatic hatchetations, as they were called, made her a national figure. Many in the temperance movement hailed her courage, while opponents saw her as a fanatic, but Carrie Nation's crusade vividly captured the desperation and zeal driving the cause. Alongside the grassroots energy of the WCTU came the political muscle of the Anti-Saloon League, founded in 1895. The ASL was a more pragmatic, politically savvy operation. The ASL was laser-focused on one goal: eliminate alcohol. They organized church congregations into voting blocks, ran intense letter-writing campaigns, and effectively delivered an ultimatum: support prohibition or lose office. Politicians soon learned that defying the ASL could mean career suicide. The League became a master of the political ground game, printing pamphlets, holding rallies, and turning out disciplined voters who would tip elections in favor of dry candidates. The broader anxieties of the time also fed the push for prohibition. Protestant, rural Americans looked at the influx of Catholic immigrants from Ireland, Italy, Germany, and elsewhere, many of whom had drinking customs as part of their heritage, and worried that their way of life was under threat. German-American families gathered in beer gardens on Sundays, Italian households poured a glass of wine at dinner. As nativist sentiment grew, such ordinary customs were caricatured as part of the liquor problem. Saloons in big cities were often run by immigrants and frequented by immigrant workers. To dry crusaders, these establishments were breeding grounds of sin and corruption, places where men wasted their pay, where brothels and gambling lurked in the back rooms and political bosses cut deals upstairs. By the 1910s, the movement to ban alcohol entirely had shifted from a far-fetched idea to a very real political possibility. State after state was holding referendums and passing laws to go dry. In many communities, alcohol was already banned at the local level. The momentum was clearly building toward something national. Episode continues with third-person narration throughout. 2. From private sorrow to public crusade. What begins as private suffering, wages disappearing across a bar, anger that flares without warning, children learning the choreography of avoidance, becomes, over time, a public crusade. Temperance in the United States did not arise from abstraction. It emerged where urban growth, industrial schedules, and precarious household budgets converged with a ready intoxicant. Women who carried the burdens of care stepped into public life because they had to. Cupboards were empty, debts were mounting, and the promise of a steady wage was dissolving evening by evening into a glass. Organizations like the Woman's Christian Temperance Union and the Anti-Saloon League learned the instruments of politics. Petitions, alliances, legislative drafts, and moral suasion. They translated domestic pain into public policy. The rhetoric sharpened as the century turned. Alcohol was no longer described merely as a temptation. It was framed as a direct agent of social ruin. Reformers believed that if they could neutralize this agent, they could disarm the chaos that followed at home. Counties went dry, then states. Pressure climbed toward a constitutional solution. Yet even as the movement grew, its descriptive accuracy and its diagnostic precision parted ways. It named a real problem, families were in danger, but it drew a straight line from liquid to consequence and mistook the line for a mechanism. The home needed safety, the workplace demanded dignity, the city required gathering places that did not demand intoxication as entry. These dimensions were visible, but prohibition of alcohol seemed cleaner to legislate than construction of alternatives. 3. Why saloons became symbols. A saloon in that era was not only a place to drink. It was an informal labor office, a room for small loans and favors, a bulletin board for leads, a precinct of machine politics, and a stage on which men who felt invisible could be noticed. For a nickel, someone poured, someone listened, someone called you by name. In neighborhoods where the rest of the day reduced a person to a number or a pair of hands, that recognition mattered. This is why reformers targeted the saloon with such intensity. They understood its centrality. Close the saloon and you do not merely reduce access to alcohol. You disrupt a social machine. But culture rarely yields to subtraction. When the role a place plays is not replaced, the behavior it organized does not vanish. It migrates. Private clubs and back rooms take the public place's function underground. Informal economies reassemble with fewer rules, less oversight, and more danger. The critical question, then, is not whether a policy can close a door. The critical question is whether it opens another door that addresses the underlying needs. Companionship, respite from exhaustion, introductions to work, a sense, however fragile, of status. What precisely are we trying to remove? The substance itself or the role it plays in managing suffering? 4. The Prohibition Experiment, Aims and Aftermath. Prohibition arrived with constitutional authority and moral confidence. Its aims were clear: fewer assaults and accidents, steadier pay brought home, a decline in corruption, healthier homes, and a return to civic virtue. The early months delivered a surface impression that the promise would hold in many places. But demand did not evaporate. It reorganized. Supply moved to illicit channels where no one inspected purity, collected taxes, or checked the age of a buyer. Enforcement became a test of each jurisdiction's budget and political will. Opportunities for bribery multiplied. Violence professionalized as organized networks took on the work previously done in view of the law. Prohibition taught a country how to break a rule together. It did suppress some forms of harm in particular towns for particular stretches of time, and these localized gains deserve acknowledgement. Yet the national lesson was sobering. When a policy is designed to subtract a substance without attending to the conditions that make the substance valuable, the harms do not end, they shift. What was once concentrated in public, regulated spaces disperses into private, unregulated ones. Measurement becomes more difficult. Consequences become less predictable. In the ledger of public health, some harms fall but others rise. Poisonings from impure product, violent competition over territory, and the corrosion of institutions asked to enforce the unenforceable. What the era got right and where it misdiagnosed. The temperance movement named genuine injuries and built civic capacity to respond. Women found durable pathways into political life. Churches and clubs learned to organize at scale. Communities practiced solidarity in the face of harm. Those are genuine achievements. But the era misdiagnosed the mechanism. It treated alcohol as the cause rather than an instrument. Remove the instrument and the causes, injury, fatigue, despair, isolation, search for a substitute. Where work ground bodies down, where wages could not stabilize a household, where public life offered few dignified places to belong, a glass served functions the statute did not recognize. Eliminate the glass and the functions recruit other tools. The misdiagnosis matters today because it encourages policies designed around the appearance of control. The spectacle of a ban feels decisive. It is legible. It can be announced and celebrated. Yet a spectacle that leaves the human drivers unchanged only displaces the scene of suffering. The harm ceases to be seen in one place and becomes harder to see in another. When families lose the little leverage they had, predictable hours, safer regulation, access to help, harm intensifies out of view. Competent policy does not mistake visibility for reality. It asks where the risk will go next and builds the path for it to go nowhere at all. 6. Translating the lesson to the present. The analogies to the current drug landscape are not metaphors, they are continuities. Substances differ in pharmacology and risk profile, but the social mathematics is consistent. If the only lever pulled is subtractive, criminalization without treatment, interdiction without services, the pattern repeats. Supply reorganizes, purity declines, people die in the shadows. Communities absorb new forms of violence, courts strain, prisons fill with the same names. The public is told that the problem has been handled because the streets are quieter. Meanwhile, families bury their dead. A competent response begins with a disciplined act of description. It distinguishes between the molecule and the human being, between the chemical and the context. It invests in housing where homelessness is a relapse variable, in trauma-informed care where trauma is the binding agent, in mental health services where depression, anxiety, and psychosis cut judgment and narrow choices. It teaches the public to recognize withdrawal as a medical event and equips bystanders with the tools to interrupt death. It uses regulation to reduce predictable harm, dose, purity, labeling, rather than pretending that lack of regulation is a deterrent. And it measures outcomes that matter. Fewer funerals, fewer infections, fewer children entering foster care because their parents were denied care. None of this denies moral agency. It refines the target of moral language. The question for a serious city is not whether it condemns harm, that is the easy part, but whether it builds systems commensurate with the weight of that harm. History keeps a ledger on that question. The entries are visible. Where subtraction stood alone, harm shifted and multiplied. Where subtraction was joined by construction of clinics, shelters, counseling, safer supply edges, employment ladders, harm fell and lives stabilized. 7. Bridging forward. The narrative that opens this episode is not ornament. It is evidence in human scale. It shows how an abstraction, vice, order, decency, enters a kitchen at midnight and arranges the furniture of a life. It also earns the pivot to analysis. A listener who has seen the scene can now hold the numbers with a steadier hand. This bridge matters for the rest of the series. From here, we will turn to psychology and neurobiology, how stress reweights reward, how loneliness and trauma compress choice, how fear resets learning. We will examine the record of punitive paradigms and the measurable gains of treatment and harm reduction working together. We will return again and again to the same discipline test. Does a proposed policy reduce death, disease, and despair? Does it preserve or restore dignity? Does it scale in the places people actually live? A century ago, the country tried subtraction as a theory of virtue. It discovered, at tremendous cost, that subtraction without construction is a theory of displacement. Today's crisis offers a chance to remember the lesson without relearning it the hard way. The task is not to be less serious than our predecessors. It is to be more precise. We can refuse the fantasy that removing a chemical removes the reasons people reached for it. We can build services equal to those reasons instead. 8. Closing reflection. If a policy promises renewal by mere removal, ask what human needs it leaves uncounted. If it cannot name those needs, it will create a market and unintended consequences. A serious society does not outsource reality to appearances. It measures what matters, funds what works, and accepts that dignity is not a luxury in health policy. It is an instrument. Where that instrument is played with patience and evidence, the noise recedes and something like order returns, not because a liquid vanished but because human pressures eased. And the artificial laboratory.